Welcome to ForTruth.net. This is Mike Lacona, and I have a special guest with me today. It's Dr. Tim McGrew. Tim is the professor of philosophy at Western Michigan University. Tim did his dissertation and PhD work at Vanderbilt University. His dissertation was on the theory of knowledge. He's written two books on epistemology. He's co-edited a recent anthology in the History and Philosophy of Science, published by Blackwell. He has written numerous articles in various journals on the theory of knowledge and epistemology. Welcome, Tim. Great to have you.
Thanks very much, Mike. Good to be here.
We just met for the first time a few weeks ago in New Orleans, and it's like I'd been wanting to talk with you because of probability theorem and Bayes' theorem, and it's like you came up to me in a subway, and we got talking, and before we know it, you and your wife and I went back to the JW Marriott there, and we talked in the lobby for an hour and a half. I think it was the fastest-paced discussion I've ever had in my life.
That's the way we like it.
I mean, we were just going back and forth, and you're telling me about Bayes' theorem and all this stuff, and Lydia's chiming in. She's absolutely brilliant. She has a PhD. Your family, I had dinner with you all last night. Just amazing. In fact, I emailed my wife and Gary Habermas and another friend of mine last night after I came back. Here, you know, we sat down, we had a good meal, and then I proceeded to play two of your three daughters in chess. The first was a six-year-old, and she was tough, and I'm proud to say that I won that one. But what really just blew my mind is when your 10-year-old beat me, and she was blindfolded. And that was just amazing. I mean, if I hadn't been there, I've heard this kind of stuff, but I had to see this with my own eyes. She had her back turned, her eyes closed the entire time. You were calling out the move. She would call out the move. You'd call out the move that I made, and you'd move the pieces for her. And she beat me, blindfolded. And then afterward, I said, good night. I can't believe this. A 10-year-old just beat me in chess, blindfolded. And your wife, Lydia, says, oh, don't get down on yourself too much, Mike. She does turn 11 next week or something like that.
In a couple of weeks, yeah. So that makes it totally okay.
So definitely from good stock she's coming. Just brilliance in your family. And your older daughter, 16, is what, one of the top 100 16-year-old chess players in the nation?
That's right. She's on that top 100 list. There are only two girls on the list. She's one of them.
Well, I want to talk today, ask you a few questions. You have been researching the history of apologetics for some time now. And you spoke about this at the Evangelical Philosophical Society Apologetics Conference, the recent one in November 2009 in New Orleans. Tell me a bit about that research.
Well, about 5 years ago, I began to dig into the history of apologetics, partly out of sheer historical curiosity. I'm just that kind of a guy. And also looking for some hidden gems that might be of value today. 2.5 years ago, I started combing through several large archives on the internet, compiling a massive database of works on historical apologetics, and the results were, frankly, astonishing. I've had a strong interest in apologetics for over 25 years now, and I had simply no idea what a wealth of material was lying hidden, waiting to be discovered or rediscovered.
Wow. Well, let me ask you, I mean, this is interesting stuff, and I know a few years ago, 2005, Dale Allison came out with a book, Resurrecting Jesus. Half of the book dealt with the resurrection, and it was just a collection of some of his papers and stuff. But he did some great stuff on the resurrection.
I've seen it.
And he was widely read in the old sources from the 19th century. The 18th century, the first half of the 20th century. I know Gary Habermas knows this stuff too, like the back of his hand. My question for you is this, though. Hasn't modern apologetics gone beyond the old stuff? I mean, why do we need to read this? Wouldn't it be true that the new stuff already takes the old stuff into consideration, updates it according to recent finds and scholarship? Wouldn't it be true that some of the old apologetic arguments no longer work?
Well, yes and no, but probably more no then yes. There are certainly some areas where modern research has made advances, and we need to take those into account. I think particularly the scientific arguments that were being offered in the 18th and the 19th century have not aged as well as some of the others, because the progress of science has shown us a lot more interesting material on all sides of the issues. There are some areas in New Testament scholarship, for example, in the manuscript evidence, where we've discovered some things that move us beyond what some of the older scholars could have referred to. I think the discovery of an older Hebrew text of the Old Testament, which in some places vindicates the New Testament use of quotations from the Septuagint, is an important example. But if we're talking about the main lines of argument for the credibility of the central historical claims of Christianity, I think that the older material was often as good as, and sometimes, frankly, better than much of the modern work that's being done by today's apologists.
Well, can you give me an example of a pearl from the past, an older work of apologetics that has been unjustly neglected?
Sure. In fact, can I give a couple hundred? is it? No, seriously.
We'll have to have two or three of these.
Right. It's impossible to select just one from among all these great works, but to pick one of many, I would say that Joseph Butler's masterwork, The Analogy of Religion, deserves to be read closely. Butler is arguing against deists.
When did he write this?
1736.
Okay.
He's arguing against people who believe that there is a God small g who wound up the universe and set it going, but who has not since intervened. They object strenuously to the claim that we have a special revelation from God in Scripture. What Butler does, and it's an ingenious move, is to argue that the same sorts of arguments that the deists used against special revelation would, if they were any good, work against general revelation as well. In other words, the deists can't have it both ways. If they're going to acknowledge the existence, power, benevolence, and wisdom of a creator, they can't use arguments against special revelation in Scripture that they won't allow to work against general revelation. But there's much more. Having drawn the sting of the deist's criticism, Butler goes on to consider the arguments from prophecy and from miracles, which he calls the direct and fundamental proofs of Christianity. And he shows a really remarkable understanding of the nature of a cumulative argument, its strength, its structure, and why it requires sustained thought to appreciate it. He also has some very shrewd remarks on the matter of answering objections to revealed religion. It's truly a masterful performance.
Wow. And now, you said this is from the 1700s. At your house last night, you brought out a collection of books and showed me that were published in the 1700s and 1800s. In fact, I held them in my hand. You handed me one, and you said, this book that you're holding in your hand was printed before George Washington was born.
That's right. It's amazing what there is out there.
That's pretty cool. Suppose someone who's listening today with an interest in apologetics, but without an extensive background in philosophy or theology, let's say they had the time to read just one of these older works, something brief and not too heavy. Maybe they just wanted to get their feet wet with it, see what this was like. Which one would you recommend?
Again, this is hard because I want to recommend a dozen things just for starters, but if I have to pick just one without knowing anything more about the prospective reader, I might name Edmund Bennett's work, The Four Gospels from a Lawyer's Standpoint. This is a very short book, just 58 pages, giving a lawyer's perspective on the evidence for the genuineness and authenticity of the Gospels. I think it makes a lovely introduction to the branch of evidential apologetics that looks at the internal evidence for the truth of the gospel record. He's looking at details that come out in the gospels and how those tend to support the traditional descriptions and the authenticity of the narratives. It would be a great introduction to historical apologetics for the complete beginner.
Wow. Now, have you read Greenleaf's book on the...
Absolutely, Simon Greenleaf's Testimony of the Evangelists. And there's actually...
How does that differ from...
Well, Greenleaf is applying the standards of courts of law, the rules like the ancient document rule, and talking a lot about the question of sorts of evidence that are admissible in court. Bennett is also a lawyer, But Bennett isn't bringing in the machinery of legal evaluation the way that Greenleaf does. Bennett has a trained mind, but is simply evaluating these things in terminology that anyone, even someone with no background in law, can understand. So they're both great works, and I highly recommend Greenleaf as well, but the Bennett is probably the easier entry point.
You showed me one last night. The guy was talking about answering someone who says all these contradictions in the Gospels. And so, okay, well, let's look at the assassination of Julius Caesar.
That's Andrews Norton, Internal Evidences for the Genuineness of the Gospels.
And this is written when?
This is was actually published posthumously. It's a mid-1800s work. And in it, Norton looks at the various sources that tell us about the assassination of Julius Caesar. And for a bit of a lark, he says, I'm going to treat these documents the way that David Friedrich Strauss, the great German destructive biblical critic, treats the gospel narratives. And then in a tour de force, Norton just makes a complete hash out of the secular sources for the assassination of Caesar. What was the name of the first conspirator to approach Caesar? Well, the sources give us different names. What was the first action that was taken in a violence against Caesar? Did someone grab his toga? If so, did he pull it up or did he pull it down? Well, the sources disagree. And it goes on and on and on in this vein. And it's just a hilarious send-up of Strauss's treatment of the Gospels. Very, very funny work.
Well, how about at the high end? Would any of these old works be of value to someone who is already thoroughly familiar with the contemporary apologetic literature?
I'm going to cheat here and recommend Nathaniel Lardner's work, Credibility of the Gospel History. In this fantastic piece of Enlightenment scholarship, Lardner collects all the non-Christian references and the patristic references from the first 5 centuries A.D., and the references to every significant person, place, or event in the New Testament, translates them, places them alongside the New Testament texts, and gives a scholarly discussion of all points of dispute. For example, the disputed question regarding the census in Luke 2 fills over 80 pages of small print, complete with various readings of the Greek text of Luke 2:2, and an exhaustive discussion of the opinions of Calvin, Beza, Prideaux, and so on, all these great authorities on the subject. Whether you agree with Lardner's own opinions or not, and sometimes I don't agree with him, I can't imagine a serious scholar who would not rejoice to see all the relevant materials gathered together in a single place.
All right. Now, you said if we allow you to cheat.
I'm cheating here because Lardner's work isn't just one book. It was originally published in 17 volumes. Even in his collected works, where the pages are large and the print is small, it fills 4.5 volumes, each of which is about 600 pages long. So taken together, this is over 2,600 pages of serious scholarly work. It's just an apologetic goldmine.
That's amazing. And people can just get a hold of these things.
Absolutely.
Free.
Yes.
They're available on the internet.
I will tell you where later, where you can go to get them. Yes.
That's amazing. Are there any of them that make a good basis for an apologetics curriculum in the 21st century? Let's say for homeschooled students or students in Christian colleges.
Absolutely. One that comes to mind immediately, and again, I'm just selecting one out of many, is William Paley's classic work, A View of the Evidences of Christianity. Paley was the Gary Habermas of the early 19th century, and this work is extremely well organized and well presented. A few of his arguments regarding the textual evidence and early quotations of the New Testament documents need to be updated, but just a few. Overall, the argument holds up very well. Paley has made good use of Lardner's work, and he scatters a lot of valuable insights throughout the book. I gave this to one of my graduate students in philosophy, actually a recent graduate, and when he finally got around to reading it, he sent me back an email saying, I know you had been strongly urging me to read this, but you should have beat me over the head with it. This is great stuff. So I take it that's a bit of an advertisement for Paley.
Wow. All right. Now, for our listeners who may not be familiar with William Paley, give us his famous watchmaker argument.
Paley, in a different work, The Natural Theology, gives an argument for design, and he starts out with an analogy. He says, suppose that in crossing a heath, I pitched my foot against a stone, and you were to ask me how it had come to be there. I might answer that for all I knew, it had lain there forever. and maybe it wouldn't be very easy to show the absurdity of that answer. On the other hand, if I came upon a watch, I would never think of giving that answer. And the reason is that I can clearly see that the watch bears the marks of design. And so Paley goes on to speak of an intelligent designing mind as the thing that we infer from looking at a watch. And I'm sure I've heard that phrase somewhere before. Intelligent designing mind. Yes, I do think I have heard that. And he argues that the contrivances of nature are in many cases mechanical. They're machines like the watch, only that there's this difference. The scope and subtlety of the mechanical contrivances of nature are just far surpassing those of any human contrivance. Mm. And so the argument is therefore that much stronger. Now, some of the specific examples that Paley uses can be accounted for in contemporary science by looking at some secondary causes that he was unaware of. On the other hand, this is not simply a God of the gaps kind of reasoning. I think John Lennox had a marvelous line in one of his debates with Richard Dawkins when he said, "Science closes some gaps and it opens others." Mm-hmm. And I think Paley would have absolutely loved to look into the cell and look at the origin of life and see the mechanical nature of nature at its bottom, and it would have given rise to an entirely new edition of the natural theology in which he would have gone into cell biology and the origins of life. I cannot imagine that he would have been anything but thrilled by modern discoveries in that way.
You say that modern science has been able to explain in natural terms some of the things that Paley appealed to for a designer. So if that's the case, how would you respond to someone who says, well, if science has been able to do that, then how do we know that 100, 200, 500 years from now, science likewise will be able to explain some of the things it hasn't been able, some of the Paley's examples in natural terms?
Well, here's what I would say.
Because we're at that God of the gaps thing.
Well, I think it's more like pushing the bump in the rug somewhere else to hide it. When modern science, for example, explains various features of the phenotype of a bird, say the way that the laminae of the feather link together in terms of an underlying genetic code that codes for these features, we haven't really gotten rid of the question of design. We've just pushed it to the level of the information in the DNA. Now, I know that it's popular to say that evolution, maybe not Darwin's own version, but some new neo-Darwinian synthesis can cope with all of this. But I'm really not persuaded that at the level of the origins of life, modern science has made much progress. In fact, I've spoken with some people who are, you know, very fond of saying that intelligent design is all bunk and push the question of the origin of life. I did this with Ken Miller at Brown University, and Ken was pretty candid that we are clueless or nearly clueless on the origins of life. Every few years you hear some excited proclamation, oh, we finally figured out some new step, and it turns out that the new step really doesn't get you very far. That's a thorny question, and it's one where I think people would do well to pay some close attention.
Ken Miller, which one's the Miller or the Miller-Urey?
No, that's a totally different Miller. That's the old experiment where they ran some electricity through a mixture in a reducing atmosphere, and
Ken Miller at Brown now.
Ken
rejects intelligent design.
Right, he's a cytologist. He's written the book Finding Darwin's God. Very bright guy, very engaging guy, friendly fellow.
Scientologist, you said?
No, scientist. He's a cytologist, a cell biologist. Specialist in cell biology. But he admits that at the level of the origin of life, we're pretty much up against the wall so far.
It seemed that way in that recent movie Expelled, when they interviewed Richard Dawkins and Michael Ruse. I mean, here are two leading evolutionists, and they really didn't have a clue on how life originated.
It's a tough problem. As Dobzhansky, who was himself an ardent evolutionist, said, prebiotic natural selection is a contradiction in terms. You can't have natural selection. You can't get the Darwinian mechanism off the ground until you have living organisms at all. So the question of the origin of life cuts deeper. That's a prior question, even to the question of the level at which Darwinian mechanisms could be employed, even in principle.
Wow. How does Dawkins respond to something like Paley's watchmaker?
Well, Dawkins is famous for having said that Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. But of course, Paley precedes Darwin, and in fact, Darwin read Paley very carefully. One of the things that is not perhaps pointed out as often as it should be is that Darwin learned how to make a cumulative case argument from his reading of Paley, because Paley makes a cumulative case argument. So Darwin is, in one sense, indebted to Paley for having taught him how the structure of a cumulative argument works. Now, I'm sure that Dawkins is persuaded that there is no longer any force to any of Paley's examples. As I said, in some cases, he would be at least to this extent right, that the things that Paley indicated as marks of design can be to some level explained in terms of deeper underlying structures. However, those deeper underlying structures themselves call for some kind of explanation. And that's where I think the debate will be moving in the next decade or so, is to look very seriously at the origins of life, the origins of the information that we find in the DNA. That's a very difficult one to get around.
Wow. So you're saying that these contemporary scientists, people like Dawkins, and some of these leading origin of life researchers, they really don't know how life began with the cell.
Well, there are clusters of scientists who are very enthusiastic about one or another of the possible scenarios. You've got Oparin's scenarios, you've got Karen Smith's clay fractures, you've got Kaufman's computer simulations. All of these have their own small bands of devotees, but there's not a single one that has emerged as the consensus position. You know, RNA world, things have their own problems. And the reason that this is difficult is that none of the proposed models has been really very successful in the laboratory, where we can control the surroundings very carefully. They really don't get us very far. You mentioned the Miller-Urey experiment. The upshot of the Miller-Urey experiment was that they got not living organisms, not even the building blocks out of which living organisms are made, but the building blocks of the building blocks out of which living organisms are made. In other words, they got tar, suitable for paving roads. I'm glad that they were excited by the result, but that's really not moving us very far in the direction of the origin of life.
Well, we've been talking about specific books. What are some of the main benefits of, say, reading widely in this older literature? Things that are over 100 years old.
Sometimes over 200, yeah.
Does it give you a different view of the overall argument?
Well, obviously, reading widely is a good idea in general, whether in older literature or more recent materials. But I think one peculiar benefit of reading the older literature is that one rediscovers some forgotten lines of argument. In the 19th century, for example, there was a whole body of literature developing the argument from undesigned coincidences. Today, very few writers show any awareness of that literature, though some commentators have apparently begun to rediscover bits and pieces of the argument. But why should we have to reinvent the wheel? It was all there in the Victorian literature. Sometimes the forgotten apologists come up with extremely clever arguments. One criticism, for example, of the pastoral epistles, the epistles of Paul toward the
first
end of the...
2 Timothy, Titus.
Right, is that these were too different from the authentic Pauline epistles, usually...
Most New Testament scholars today believe that Paul didn't write those names.
That's right. And one of the principal arguments is that the vocabulary is too different from the acknowledged Pauline epistles. But what would happen if we were to apply a similar line of argument to the works of Shakespeare? Well, reading around in the Victorian literature, you'll find that the test has been made with hilarious results. Julius Caesar, one of the famous plays of Shakespeare, would have to be thrown out as inauthentic or at least as heavily interpolated, because in one scene he uses the word pulpit 5 or 6 times And the word pulpit never occurs in all the rest of the Shakespearean corpus. Another one. Arguments from silence are the stock in trade of contemporary destructive biblical criticism, and they have been so since the 19th century.
By the way, just back to the Caesar.
Oh, sure, yeah.
A little anecdote here. Gary Habermas and I are really good friends, and we email or talk on the phone very frequently. And several years ago, I'm talking probably 6-7 years ago, I was looking at some of this stuff in terms of authorship of, say, Ephesians and some of the disputed Pauline corpus. And so I had emailed him something, and he emailed me back. Now, a lot of times he'll call me Mikey. Well, he calls me Michael in this, and he used an ampersand, which I had never seen him use before. And then he made some grammatical mistakes. I know when you don't worry about those things when you're doing an email most of the time. But he made some that I thought, wow, I've never seen something like this before. And then at the end, he signed it GRH rather than his name, Gary. And he'd never signed it GRH. Well, like a week before, 2 weeks before, he told me that he just hired a graduate assistant and that grad assistant was going to be taking care of a lot of his emails.
There we go.
So I emailed back and I said, Doc, you didn't write this email. Your grad assistant did. Here's why. One, you called me Michael. Two, you used ampersand. Three, grammatical errors. Four, you signed it GRH. Conclusion, Paul did not write Ephesians. Because we had been talking about this. So he writes back and he says, Mikey, I did write the email. And I frequently signed it GRH. I just haven't done it with you in the past. And and all these things he said. So conclusion, Paul wrote Ephesians.
Beautiful.
And I thought, you know, this is all those hundreds of emails that we had exchanged. And one came in with some unique features in it. And it would be easy using the methods of the critics today to say, okay, well, Gary didn't write this. But obviously he did. And so this is really fascinating, this stuff. You're saying, go ahead, you were bringing something else.
Sure, yeah. I was going to go on to say that arguments from silence, arguments that somebody leaves out information which he surely would have reported if he had really been the author of this and it had really happened.
They always say, Paul doesn't mention the empty tomb.
Well, I think that it is implied in 1 Corinthians 15, but in any event, Paul's not writing a biography of Jesus.
Right.
He's writing letters to churches to give doctrinal advice, practical advice, and occasionally to box somebody in the ears. And, you have to consider the genre of that. By the way, just in parentheses, if you look at Paul's epistles and read through them asking, what is he presupposing that his audience already knows? What is Paul writing that would make no sense if his audience didn't already know some things about Jesus? You will learn something. It's a fascinating exercise. But in general, this whole treatment of arguments from silence, this was thrashed in the older apologetics literature. And I have not seen much awareness of the fact that it was thrashed in the modern literature. I think that's something we could recover. When you realize that this is a mode of argument used on the New Testament documents that would produce obvious absurdities when applied to the documents of secular history, you have a new perspective on the entire shape of the argument. You realize that a double standard is being employed, and people are getting away with something in New Testament scholarship that they would never be allowed to get away with in, say, Pliny scholarship.
You hear about books like Bart Ehrman and Elaine Pagels and Karen King and some of those about lost scriptures. Maybe you should come out with a book, Tim, called The Lost Arguments for the Reliability of the New Testament.
With the difference that I think some of those lost scriptures were lost for fairly good reasons, and the older apologetics literature, I think, probably not for good reasons. Let me just add one more to the list of benefits of reading around in the older literature. I think if one does that for a while, one gets a really good sense of just how tightly integrated the New Testament narrative is within the history of the time as it's disclosed to us through the secular sources like Tacitus and sources like Josephus. I should mention George Rawlinson's work, which I think is just wonderful in this respect. And, that's a benefit. I'll add that you can get some good work in modern writers on this subject. I think E.M. Blakelock and Craig Keener have done some wonderful work on this subject. On the other hand, the older works are available for free, and that has to be a plus for some people.
Mm. Okay. Well, now you've mentioned the term undesigned coincidences a few times. Can you give an example or two of what this is, or you know, how it plays out?
Sure. An undesigned coincidence in the Gospels, for example, occurs when one account of an event leaves out a bit of information that doesn't affect the overall picture, but a different account indirectly supplies the missing detail, maybe answering some natural question raised by the first. Forgers don't want to leave loose ends like that that might raise awkward questions. They take care to tie everything together neatly, but these are just the sorts of things we would expect to find in authentic records of the same real event told by different people. I'll give you an example. The account in Luke 23 of Jesus' first trial before Pilate is very curious. The Jews accuse Jesus of forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, and that's an arrant lie, and then they accuse him of saying that he himself is Christ, a king. So there's the charge that's really supposed to appeal to Pilate. Hey, he's making himself to be a king. Caesar makes kings. People don't make themselves kings. Pilate apparently takes the charge seriously. Now, here's how Luke recounts Pilate's action. And Pilate asked him, saying, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "Thou sayest it." And that's just a Greek expression that means, "Yep, you said it." Then said Pilate to the chief priests and to the people, "I find no fault in this man." So here's the puzzle. The Jews accuse Jesus of making himself to be a king. Pilate asks him whether he is, and Jesus acknowledges it. And then, with Jesus' admission still ringing in his ears, Pilate proclaims him innocent.
Mm.
This makes no sense at all on the face of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But here, as in many other cases, another gospel supplies the detail that we're missing. In John 18, we get a fuller account of Pilate's interview with Jesus. Pilate asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world." And they go on and they finish out that conversation that winds up with Pilate saying, "What is truth?"
Mm-hmm.
And then when he walks out and speaks to the Jews and says, "I find in him no fault at all," we understand it, because he supplied the missing detail. It's not an earthly kingdom.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
Well, but this, hold on, I'm not done. This is a twofer, okay? This case is really interesting because the passage in John itself contains a mystery. Why does Pilate ask Jesus whether he is the king of the Jews? As John tells the story, this comes up unexpectedly. It's not one of the accusations against Jesus that John records. But this is explained in the very passage of Luke that we started with. The charge that Jesus claimed to be a king was one of the charges the Jews made against him. John omits this detail, so Pilate's question seems random. It just comes out of nowhere. The two gospel accounts provide mutual support in a very interesting and persuasive sense. No reasonable person would ascribe this sort of double coincidence to forgery or the parallel development of mm-hmm. legends. Mm-hmm. This is real testimony of real people who knew whereof they spoke. It's the stuff of real history.
Wow. Wow.
And there's lots more where that came from.
You know, I know that historians today, as well as in antiquity, are selecting the materials that they... I mean, you just can't include everything.
Absolutely.
When I read the Gospels, I try to read them in isolation, but it's hard to do because you're so familiar with all of them. And just what you picked up there.
Sure.
It is fascinating.
And I wish I could claim that it was my original discovery, but it is not. I owe it to the literature of the 19th century, where this was very fully developed. There's a whole book called Undesigned Coincidences by John James Blunt, and it was very, very popular. But contemporary authors very rarely take notice of it. The only reference I found to it in a modern scholar is a footnote by F.F. Bruce in one of his essays for the Bulletin of the John Rylands Library. And he's very enthusiastic and points out that Paley pioneered this kind of argument in his Horae Paulinae, great work of apologetics, one of Paley's greatest works, maybe his very greatest work. And then the same thing was picked up and developed, and there's this whole literature out there waiting to be rediscovered.
Wow. So this is very valuable, this older literature. You mentioned Bruce used it, but that's only in a footnote. You know, how is it that today's Christian scholars have forgotten about these these great old works? Why don't they use them today?
I have hard words for the level of historical amnesia in the contemporary Christian community. Like I mentioned, a few of the very best modern authors seem to know some of the older literature. Bill Craig, for example, has read a good bit of the literature from the Deist controversy. You mentioned that Gary is pretty widely read. But I think it's been largely historical accident that these have fallen out of the eye of the Christian scholars in the main. Think how it would look 100 years from now if someone were trying to study the history of 20th century apologetics and had forgotten even the names of C.S. Lewis, William Lane Craig, Gary Habermas. What would the picture of apologetics in the 20th century look like if we forgot its greatest figures? And I think that the parallel is a very good one. There are really, truly great names that we've forgotten, and maybe we need to do some penance, but we certainly need to rediscover these.
So how did we forget them? Did it just...
I don't have a comprehensive answer to that question. I think one possibility is that when the fundamentalist-modernist controversy erupted fully in the early 20th century, the modernists were uninterested in any apologetic arguments that might seem to be tending towards the conclusion that the Gospels are reliable and that we can get a compelling and accurate picture of the rise of the early church from the epistles of Paul and Acts. And some of the fundamentalists were interested in no literature that did not expressly make use of a very high doctrine of inspiration. And some of the older apologetic literature just doesn't speak to that at all. And indeed, in some cases, the authors may not have been advocates of a high view of inspiration, but their historical work is of value regardless of their position on a particular theological point. But I think that perhaps when that polarization took place, that was one of the places where neither camp was interested in the older literature, and as a consequence, it was not really studied at seminaries of either type.
It would almost be, it sounds like, and tell me if I'm right, as though the inerrancy debate became so polarizing that, say, the works of someone who just doesn't give any attention to inerrancy, but has a high view of Scripture, like an N.T. Wright,
sure,
like a Ben Witherington,
sure,
that they just forget their works.
Right. If we were to have another such flare-up of that debate, it is possible that someone like C.S. Lewis, who was not an inerrantist at all, might be one of the casualties.
Mm.
And that would be really tragic.
It would. I don't see that coming. I mean, you've got
people like
Habermas and Craig. None of the big apologists today who are out there and scholars are using inerrancy in their arguments.
Right.
Someone like Habermas and Craig believe in biblical inerrancy, but they don't use it in their arguments at all. It doesn't even play any part in it. In fact, I know these guys, and it doesn't play any part in their arguments or convincing them of something. They bracket that issue while they proceed in their investigation.
Right, and I think that that kind of bracketing can be a healthy move if it keeps us from being sidetracked and distracted from the actual force of the historical evidence. And it is at least a conjecture that that's one of the ways that we came to forget some of this older literature. For what it's worth, I haven't done a comprehensive study of the issue, but off the top of my head, that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Well, Tim, where do people go who are interested in exploring this literature further?
Right now, I would say the first place you should stop off is a website that is historicalapologetics.org. That's all run together, no dots, no spaces, no underscores. Historicalapologetics.org. There's a growing collection of sources there. A lot of them have been culled from other sites and other sources. Some of them I've scanned in myself and uploaded, so that's a sizable and growing collection. We've tried to organize it well. We're going to have some search tools going up to enable you to search through the documents and find, you know, all the references to Strauss. If you really want to see several thousand documents that all refer to Strauss, that'll be a place to go. But that's a growing website. There's also a website, Classic Apologetics, website that has a lot of material of apologetics available. I would recommend that site as well. That's not my own, but that's valuable.
What is that one?
I think it's classicapologetics.com.
Okay.
And that's a very useful website to go to as well. So I would recommend that as well. I'm developing the content on historicalapologetics.org, and we hope to have ultimately several thousand works available there for people to browse.
Wow. Well, this is an exciting, I don't know if you call it a discovery or a rediscovery. Or
a rediscovery, definitely.
This is interesting.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, thanks so much, Tim, for spending some time with us today, and God bless your work.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Mike.